I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Delegate Maggie McIntosh joins me with reaction to the passing of Maryland House Speaker Michael Bush, who died yesterday, a day before the General Assembly session comes to a close. As the leadership in Annapolis changes, what's ahead for Baltimore City? This morning, the City Council called on Mayor Catherine Pugh to resign. Her spokesman claims she is planning to come back to work as soon as she recovers from a bout of pneumonia. Pugh is the latest in a long list of Baltimore officials caught up in corruption scandals. How can public trust in government be restored? Journalist Sean Yost, political consultant Catalina Byrd, and the activist Davon Love join me with a critique of the city's political players and what it'll take to fix Baltimore. Midday starts right after these headlines. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Today is sine die in Annapolis, the final day of the 2019 Maryland General Assembly. And it will be a final day unlike any other. Yesterday afternoon, just before 3:30, Speaker of the House Michael Bush died from complications related to pneumonia. He served as the Speaker for 17 years, longer than anyone in the history of our state. Born in Baltimore, Mike Bush was raised in Annapolis. He was first elected to the House to represent Anne Arundel County in 1986. He served as the chair of the powerful House Economic Matters Committee for many years, and he rose to become Speaker in 2002. Lawmakers on both sides of the aisle are remembering him as a transformational leader and a beloved colleague. Mike Bush was 72 years old. Joining me now from the state capitol on this very busy day, Delegate Maggie McIntosh. She represents Baltimore City and serves as the chair of the House Appropriations Committee. Delegate, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I know that you and Speaker Bush were very close. Your thoughts as you remember your good friend?
Well, it's an extraordinary emotional day for everyone. We are working through sine die, hard as we can in his memory. That's what he'd want us to do. But I will say that, you know, when you think of Mike Bush, and when I think of him, I think of him first as one of the best fathers I've ever known. He loved his two daughters. As someone who loved Maryland, he loved every inch of this state, particularly the Chesapeake Bay. And as also someone who was just a great coach and leader for all of us in the House of Delegates. Whether you're a Republican or Democrat, he, I think, saw the best in people and really did try to diversify leadership, set a progressive agenda for the House, and all of us are just stunned and saddened at his passing.
You mentioned Mr. Bush as a coach and a leader. A lot of people have applied that term to him. His leadership style, very different, for example, from Senate President Mike Miller. People don't talk about Mike Miller as a coach, but they talked about Mike Bush as a coach all the time. What does that mean? What kind of style was his?
You know, he looked out at the House members or the members of the Democratic, you know, caucus, and he looked at us as his team. We're the team that's going to put together an agenda and get it through for Marylanders. And he always was on the lookout for good talent, regardless of jurisdiction, regardless of sex, regardless of color, regardless of sexual orientation. He really picked and put people that he thought had talent and potential in the positions and let them flourish. And so he ran, I think, the Democratic caucus in the House much like he did, you know, a football team or a baseball team or any team that he coached. And by the way, I think he coached almost every team his daughters played on. So he looked for talent. He grew talent. He encouraged talent. And he really did you know, move talent up in the House leadership.
And you were one of those talents that that benefited from that. You're chair of the House Appropriations Committee. He worked closely with you on a number of bills. Do you remember the first time you met Mike Bush? Do you remember your first interaction with him?
Yeah, I think it was when I was new to the House of Delegates and I had a bill in his committee. And I can't remember what the bill was, but I remember I kept pestering him about it. And, you know, because I'm new and I don't know what I'm doing, so I just kept pestering. Every time I saw him, I'd say, da-da-da, my bill. And he was gracious, and he just at one point put his arm around me and said, relax, I'm going to take care of your bill. I said, thank you. But he always, always was very supportive of me in that way. But, yeah, he was a coach, you know.
Delegate Maggie McIntosh, she represents the 43rd Legislative District in the Maryland House and serves as the chair of the House Appropriations Committee. Delegate, I know you have a very busy day today. I appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We will have a full report on the Maryland General Assembly tomorrow on Midday. Maggie McIntosh, one of the people being strongly considered as a successor to Mike Bush as the Speaker of the House in the Maryland House. We're going to take a quick break now. When we return, a conversation about leadership in Baltimore City. The city council has called on Mayor Catherine Pugh to resign. We'll get reaction from Davon Love, Catalina Byrd, and Sean Yost, and we'll take your calls and comments. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. We will also be streaming our conversation on the WYPR Facebook page. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday. Stay with us.
This is 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Now, a conversation about the latest scandal to rock Baltimore City Hall. Less than a month after the swearing in of a new police commissioner who replaced a commissioner who's about to go to prison for tax evasion, Baltimore City Mayor Catherine Pugh has taken an indefinite leave of absence to recover from a bout of pneumonia as multiple investigations are underway examining her deals to sell her Healthy Holly books. This morning, the entire city council, with the exception of Mayor ex officio Jack Young, signed a letter calling on the mayor to resign, saying, quote, "The Baltimore City Council believes that it is not in the best interest of the city of Baltimore for you to continue to serve as mayor. We urge you to tender your resignation effective immediately." Last week, we spoke with three members of the city council, all of whom pointed to the importance of moving forward. But what does moving forward mean? Move forward with whom? Move forward towards what? Is there a cure for corruption in Baltimore? What needs to happen for citizens to believe that their government, their police force, their elected officials are operating ethically and in the best interests of the city instead of themselves? Joining me now, Catalina Byrd. She's a media consultant and political strategist. Davon Love is the director of public policy for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, a grassroots organization that advocates for African Americans. And Sean Yost, he's the Baltimore editor of the Afro newspaper and a co-host of WYPR's podcast, Truth and Reconciliation. He's also the author of After Freddie Gray, Real Stories from One of America's Great Imperiled Cities. Welcome back to all of you. It's good to see you.
Thanks, Tom.
Listeners, you are welcome to join us. What do you think about Mayor Pugh? Do you think she should resign? Do you think that she should be given some time and a due process, as some have suggested? Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. Davon Love, let me start with you and get your reaction, first of all, to the passing of Michael Bush as the Speaker of the House. Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle issued a letter urging the legislature to take some time in naming his replacement.
Absolutely. I think, you know, one of the things that it's important to understand about Maryland politics is both the Speaker and the Senate President have tremendous power. And so it's important to us that the decisions that are made about who succeeds both Bush and Miller, and because there will be a major transition very soon in the leadership, it's important to us that that process take place publicly and that there's time given so that the public can participate. Because I, as a person who has spent a lot of time doing advocacy in Annapolis, one of the things that has been an impediment to real substantive change has been the kind of backroom deals. That's just a part of the process of lawmaking. And so it's, for us, it's just important to bring it out to the public, because that's really the only place where we have a chance of making sure the things that are important to us get done.
Catalina Byrd, transparency when it comes to picking successors to Mr. Bush and Mr. Miller, who's also encountering a number of health challenges himself.
I completely agree with Davon and LBS's position in thinking, like Davon's saying, in terms of backroom deals, legislation that been killed on sunny die and disappears until after midnight. You know, a lot of things have happened that prevented us from moving, not just the city, but the state forward as a result of which. So the more inclusive the process is in the selection, the better off it would be for the people.
And Sean Yost, in terms of the legacy of Speaker Bush, what do you think it'll be ultimately?
You know, I don't have a real clear, cogent, you know, thought about the legacy of Speaker Bush. And I don't mean that in a disparaging way. I just didn't know him very much. And when I reported in Annapolis, I was so focused on specific issues that I wasn't even necessarily concerned with specifically who Speaker Bush is or his history leading up to that time. But I would echo what Davon and Catalina say as well. And only to add that the culture of political corruption is pervasive from Annapolis to Baltimore City. So that's obviously what we're ultimately grappling with, specifically as communities of color. So.
And Davon Love, your reaction in general to what's happened in the Assembly, General Assembly so far. I mean, when you're talking about backroom deals, a bunch of that's happening as we speak on this last day. Leaders for a Beautiful Struggle, very much advocating against the bill allowing the Johns Hopkins University police force to come into effect. Speaker Bush did support that bill, although he wasn't nearly as boisterous about it as, say, Senator President Miller or Governor Hogan, for that matter. But in terms of Mr. Bush's allegiance with your organization and some of the priorities that you have, how did he fare, and how did the General Assembly fare in general this term?
Well, in terms of this particular session, you know, this actually wasn't a particularly good session for LBS on a number of fronts. And I find that to be important for your listeners to think about, given the conversation that folks had about how more progressive this General Assembly would be. You know, there was conversation about new voices coming in. And one of the things that, you know, I was afraid of in this session, I think, bore it out, is that, you know, you can bring more kind of progressive folks into the General Assembly, but if you don't change the nature of how leadership is organized in the Democratic Party, you know, leadership structure that really dominates, you know, has a supermajority in both houses or both chambers, then it limits the ability for those progressive legislators to be able to make their mark. And I think the Johns Hopkins Police Force is a quintessential example of that. It was a very high priority of leadership, you know, both Mike Bush's office and Senate President Mike Miller's office. It was a very high priority. And it was very clear to me that the word on down, right, that the work that leadership did to make that bill pass, it really should demystify anybody's notion that the way that the General Assembly works is one that's democratic in nature, and that it's actually been very hierarchical, that the presiding office kind of set the agenda. Here, you know, there are things that are going to come out, things that the chairs can have some discretion over, and things that they don't want to come out. And so I think it's really important. So for our issues, I think the Johns Hopkins Police Force is an example of the limitations when you don't really address the leadership of the party and the institution itself.
And Catalina Byrd, as Davon mentions, people talked about a number of progressive people who were elected in the last election. A number of women increased in the Maryland legislature tremendously. What's your assessment of this particular session in terms of, you know, what Davon's talking about, how they've been operating, how they've been working, and the things that they've accomplished?
Coming off of last year's election, I made the personal self-care choice to sit this session out. The posturing going into 2020 was going to be very prevalent, and that was obvious, and very little good was going to get done, quite frankly. And I got that sense in the way that almost all of those district races went, the number of contenders and people that were unseated. I think that we've confused progressive with young or different person in a seat, and the way that the word is being used is not the way it's intended. It's an emotional dog whistle to get people to buy into a practice of the same thing with different people pulling the strings. But nothing is changing, and that's what Marylanders and Baltimoreans are tired of. And I just didn't go. There was no one willing to look at domestic violence legislation this session. They had priorities that some were very explicit about that were not about protecting women. And that seems insane to me in a party that finds its base in black women. So I personally just sat it out. I followed closely what was happening. I saw the bills that should have been getting progressed, but Johns Hopkins just took the air out of everything and trying to create what I don't know anybody really understands is an alternate police department that would basically have citywide jurisdiction that would not be under the federal consent decree. So they have no oversight and have a history of civil rights violations in communities of color. And people of color push this. And that conversation and that context is lost somewhere, and I'm not quite sure how or where, but it's incredibly disheartening.
I mean, you had Mayor Catherine Pugh, you had Congressman Cummings, you had other black political leaders and white political leaders very much in favor of this Hopkins police force as a specific example. But when it comes to, you know, Catalina's point, Sean Yost, I mean, you got someone like, for example, Mary Washington, a very progressive politician, not particularly young. She's not an old person, but she's not young. She's youngish. Mm-hmm. She unseats Joan Carter Conway, who had, you know, been in the legislature for a long time. But maybe the needle didn't move in a way that people thought they were going to perhaps be able to move it. And we have this scandal in the city of Baltimore, which, you know, I think probably made a reputational hit in Annapolis for the city.
I mean, we're at a, what do we want to say, a titanic moment in the political life, political history of Baltimore and in the region. We can't even, I mean, I'm still trying to wrap my mind around everything that is coming down all at the same time.
Yeah, it's happening.
I've never
and furious,
seen anything like this in my lifetime. So, you know, we can speak about specific elements of what's transpired, and Hopkins takes the air out of everything, to Catalina's point. But we're really in a really intense situation in our city, and what it takes is some really deep thought and some powerful action on the part of really the grassroots, because the foundation, the powers that be, are moving quickly to consolidate. So, mm-hmm.
And Davon Love, when it comes to Catherine Pugh, has Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle have a public position about whether or not the mayor should resign?
We haven't taken a public position. I think it goes without saying. I mean, I think, you know, it's apparent to everybody that she's not in a position to be able to govern in any, you know, meaningful way at this point, given all the things that we know. I mean, one of the things that I will say is that when we talk about the crisis in leadership, and I think, you know, Mayor Pugh participated in the culture of corruption of the Baltimore political and business community. And unfortunately, there has been, in my estimation, and much of the media's attention to it, a myopia in looking at Mayor Pugh and her deals, almost framing them as if there's something exceptional about it. You know, as if it's something like anyone that is clear about the nature of how business and politics is done in Baltimore understands that what the mayor did is par the course. And so for me, the crisis really, because I think corruption is the symptom. The crisis is white corporate control over the political and economic destinies of a majority black city. And that our, you know, black folks that are in elected office oftentimes are having to capitulate to corporate interest, right, or to kind of mainstream political interest in order to secure the finances and get into the networks that get you elected, while delivering only, for the most part, symbolic victories to the masses of black folks in this city. And until folks are clear about undermining the way in which the corporate sector is essentially able to curate Black folks that come before our community, that become elected officials, again, in a majority Black city. Until folks are willing to come to grips with that, we're essentially rearranging the chairs on the Titanic.
But is this is the instance of Mayor Pugh an example of white corporate control? Or are you saying that Mayor Pugh was participating in the white corporate control?
She's participating.
Even though she's a Black woman.
Right, right.
She should
and
be thought of as part of the white establishment.
Exactly. I mean, and that's one of the things, to Catalina's point about the importance of understanding the sophistication of the system of racism and white supremacy. That it's not merely just about, or really at all, about the faces of the people that move the system. It's a question of the impact that that system has on people. The system that exists in Baltimore and in the United States around the world is a system that undermines the humanity, quality of life of people of African descent, people of color, poor people in general. And so it's important that we understand that what the mayor did was participate in an arena, in an arrangement, right? Where, and I think sometimes too many of us, I'm talking about Black folks that enter public office who ingratiate ourselves into those networks. Many of us, I think, lose the self-awareness to understand that for the folks that are in that network, we're merely just mascots for their political and economic interests. And until there's enough self-awareness to understand that what needs to happen is investment in the mundane, slow work of building independent, Black, grassroots, accountable, political, and economic power, which is not something that the white mainstream is used to hearing. Like, unfortunately, and I appreciate this show to be able to provide an opportunity for listeners that wouldn't otherwise even hear that, to be able to grapple with what that means for a city like Baltimore, that Black political power that is grassroots, accountable, and independent, why that's important, not just for Black folks, but why that's important for the entire city of Baltimore.
And Catalina, you're a political operative, you're an analyst, you study this stuff, you work on campaigns. What do you make of the fact that last week, when I had Leon Pinkett, Zeke Cohen, and Sharon Middleton on this show, only Zeke Cohen was the one, he was the only one who said at that point that the mayor should resign. But as of this morning, the entire council has signed a letter saying that the mayor should resign. What is different about this Monday as opposed to last Monday when the mayor took her leave of absence?
Well, the story didn't go away, number one. And I think that some people, because of their relationship to the mayor, were trying to be polite, right? Because essentially they all play for the same team, whether they agree or not. They're all Democrats. They all come through a similar power structure, and their money comes from the same places. So I think that everyone was kind of hedging their bets to see where is the bottom, because we were at some point trying to figure out what else can come out. I mean, you know, I think that was Thursday or Friday that J.P. Grant came out about the $100,000 that he had spent on books, so he believed. So I understand relationship, and I also understand ego and attitude and looking forward in your own personal careers. There's some people that are not going to want to be on the wrong side of her if she returns, as she is still maintaining, or her office is still maintaining, that she will do. Because of the structure of the city of Baltimore and the way our charter works, it's a very, very, very heavy mayoral power structure, similar to what we were talking about in Annapolis with the speaker. So those are individuals who are trying to make sure that they're able to be effective to their constituencies, I would assume, or at least look that way, that are trying to kind of stay in the gray area of this until we see where the bottom is and how bad is as bad as it gets before anything starts to turn around.
Let's go to the phones. If I could take a look at this screen to Jack in Wyman Park. Jack, welcome to Midday.
This is Jack. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir. You're on the air. What's on your mind?
Okay. So, regards to addressing the issue of corruption in the city of Baltimore, my recommendation is that the city have an audit on several different levels. First of all, it should have a fiscal audit of each department, and it should be on a yearly basis. Secondly, I strongly urge that there be a service delivery audit in terms of what the plans are for the year and plans accomplished. And thirdly, as a part of that, there should be an audit of all the timesheets, of course, which would be part of the fiscal audit. But that should be something that should be done on a yearly basis.
All right. Well, thanks for that call, Jack. And Sean Yost, all the folks running for mayor in 2016 agreed with Jack. Oh, we're going to have audits of this and audits of that. We're going to have audits on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, the city auditor has resigned because she feels like she has been unable to do her job in a legitimate way, evidently.
Well, I mean, the old saying, follow the money, is apparent here in Baltimore. And ultimately, if you find it, if you follow the money, then you unearth all the, I don't know what adjective I want to use, but you unearth a lot of shenanigans, I'll be polite, that have transpired in our city for how many decades and generations, I guess. But people have been calling for audits for how, I mean, audits of the Baltimore City Public School System, audits of the police department, audits of this, audits of that. And who knows what would be unearthed if we actually had a legitimate, plausible audit of city agencies in Baltimore. It would be extraordinary.
Yeah, and I'm sure the mayor's office would suggest that, you know, audits, in fact, are taking place. But again,
and
a city audit wouldn't have unearthed the fact that, you know, Catherine Pugh is an individual, right, and this private company that she founded is getting, because this money was not coming to her campaign, as we understand it. It was coming to her company, and she was doling it out to some other campaigns. But this was about her self-enrichment, at least from what it appears to be, from what we know. And she has not been charged with a crime. She has not been charged even with an ethical violation at this juncture.
Well, one of the things I think, and I try to explain to people in context that there's a difference between politics and policy, right? And one of the downsides to that is people run on a lot of things, audits, higher living wage, all of those things. And by the time they get in office, they're not held accountable to the things that they said while running. And before you know it, you look up and it's another election year and we're being emotionally pulled in another direction on whatever is the dog whistle for that. I mean, every 18 months, essentially, we're in an election cycle. And at some point, somebody has to become the watchdog. And I give lots of credit to LBS because they do a fabulous job of doing it, of holding those people accountable, what they said to get those votes. I just don't understand at this juncture in my life, especially watching all, how many people still allow themselves to be exploited by the Democratic Party and have made no real earnest effort in helping the Green Party build as an alternative power structure, looking at changing parties, anything, because we're a closed primary state, something that allows that machine to be broken up so that there can be some kind of checks and balances. And that's the part in the moment I think that we ultimately should get to, or hopefully will get to, in the days and weeks to come.
And Catalina Byrd, are you yourself contemplating a run for office? And if you ran, what would you run for, and on what party would you run in?
So in 2011, I ran for mayor as an independent and was 400 signatures short of getting on the ballot. I am contemplating it, but again, for ballot access, if I did it this time, I would run as a Republican. I think a lot of people have associated me with the Republican Party for years from my time in the Ehrlich administration and very vocally supporting Governor Hogan. But as far left as the Democratic Party has gone, my values are still actually quite conservative, like I was raised with, so that is what my team and I are considering.
And Daron Love, you said that, you know, Mayor Pugh's resignation is kind of a foregone conclusion.
It kind of goes without saying. I think it's like a pretty tame thing at this point to suggest.
I mean, it's a tame thing to suggest, but we have no reason to believe that once the mayor is feeling better and she's recovering from a very serious illness. I mean, you know, Speaker Bush passed away from complications of pneumonia. This is no trifling matter. So we wish the mayor all the best with her in her personal health. But she, you know, her spokesperson, James Bentley, told The Sun on Saturday that she's going to come back to work. I mean, I wonder why it is everyone is just assuming she's going to resign.
I think this is kind of me, you know, giving my opinion here, is I imagine that it would be helpful for her team to say that, to provide some leverage for when potentially criminal charges may be brought, and that be a part of whatever deal is made. So that's my rationale as to why that would be a statement. I find the thought that the mayor could come back to be a political impossibility at this point. I guess anything's possible, but I just find it to be, you know, far.
Sean,
yes?
I agree with Devon. And I doubt if she's going to come back, but if she did, could she conceivably win? It seems rather implausible.
Well, forget about winning for the moment, because if she came back, she'd still have 2 years before she had to run again.
Right.
I mean, could she govern? I mean, what does it take to govern?
I don't. How could she possibly govern?
Right. And how could this fraudulent and unethical behavior of hers that is alleged by the news reports that we've seen. And again, we've got three investigations going on at the moment: the state prosecutor's office, the inspector general of the city of Baltimore, and the Maryland Insurance Fund, or Insurance Commission, rather, all looking into various aspects of this. How could this have been unearthed other than, you know, the University of Maryland medical system reporting things and disclosing these no-bid contracts? I mean, what is there anything currently in the city charter that would lead us to understand that the mayor is enriching her private company while she's in office? And it seems to be clear that she's trading on her influence and trading on her position.
But ultimately, no, I don't think there would be a way for it to be detected. But at the, but ultimately, don't we have to, if we really want to craft the change that everybody's been talking about, that, we've been working on individually and collectively, don't we have to look at the reality, and I think Davon spoke to it earlier, the reality that this is business as usual for Baltimore City, specifically in the mayor's office? I mean, I suspect every mayor probably in my lifetime has, operated within the same parameters that Mayor Pugh has operated in. I mean, to varying and lesser degrees.
Yeah, but you don't hear about this kind of thing with Don Schaefer or Kurt Schmoke.
Well,
or
you don't hear about
Du
it.
Du Burns. Well, so okay, we don't hear about it. So why? Well, I mean, because this the cynicism that is generated by this kind of activity on behalf of, you know, when it's done by public officials does get people assuming that everybody's crooked. But in fact, I think there are a lot of politicians who are in it for the right reasons and who really are committed. I mean, Davon Love, you yourself have run for office. Kat has run for office. I mean, the political system is the system we have. Whether it's broke or not, it's what we got. You spend all of your day, you know, between January and April down in Annapolis mm-hmm. trying to influence from the inside.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. A few things. One is that we have to look at the collective culture of politics and business in Baltimore, and that what you see when you look at major institutions, you see very little willingness to be held accountable outside of the networks that mutually benefit from being party to certain kinds of arrangements. So what I mean by that is if you look at the board, UMMS's board, you don't have folks who are being served by the medical system, right? The community that is most directly impacted by the challenges that face our community. You don't see folks like that are on those boards, right? You don't see them put in positions of leadership. You don't see people who exist outside of the kind of curated political business community. You look at the Greater Baltimore Committee, right? And you look at the tremendous power that they have in terms of putting forward people for public office, being able to essentially create, you know, political careers as a result of their money, influence, and those networks. And so what we're suggesting is that there's one thing. An individual person's ideas does not get them elected. It's about who funds you. It's about who stands to benefit if you're in public office. And it's about what's your socialization and training. To me, those are the three things that say more about a candidate or a person running for office or in office than anything else they could possibly say. And it's important, I think, for us as a city, for, you know, people in Baltimore City and around the state, to really look at those aspects of a person's career as opposed to the things they say. Because it's really when you look at those resources, those networks, that's where you really understand where power is.
When we come back, I want to talk about another organization that's involved in this scandal. It could be peripherally or it could be pretty seriously, and that's the Associated Black Charities. They've been involved. So we want to talk about that. We're going to take some calls when we come back. We are going to take a break. Catalina Byrd is with us. She's a political strategist and media consultant. Sean Yost is the Baltimore editor of The Afro and co-host of Truth and Reconciliation podcast here at WYPR. And Davon Love is the director of public policy for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. We will have more when we come back after a break. You can join us then at 410-662-8780, our email midday at wypr.org, our Twitter handle at midday WYPR, and we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. Before we go to break, on Mondays here on Midday, it's our practice to read the names of the people who've lost their lives to violence during the previous week. We do so to stand in witness to their untimely deaths, and we remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. So far in 2019, 71 people in Baltimore City have lost their lives to violence. Last week, police released the identities of five victims whose deaths were first reported during the 2 weeks before last. Their names are Kion Gaither, age 27, Samuel Dietrich, age 30, Tyree Lee, age 39, Kenneth Maddox, age 39, and Lamont Green. He was 17 years old. Last week, two people lost their lives to violence in Baltimore. Police have identified one of those victims. His name is Alfredo Braithwaite. He was 40 years old. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up tomorrow on our program, a look back at this year's General Assembly, which ends tonight at midnight. Many high-profile bills have already been decided over the past 90 days, but the debate does continue on a number of issues as legislators make last-minute appeals and deals. So tomorrow we'll look at what passed and what failed in Annapolis this year and the future of the legislative leadership. My guests will be WYPR's Rachel Bay, Josh Kurtz of Maryland Matters, and the Daily Record's Brian Sears. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow. If you just joined us today, we're discussing possible changes to the landscape of political leadership in the city of Baltimore. In a 2015 investigation conducted by the Center for Public Integrity, Maryland as a state received an overall grade of D. The study, which analyzes state governance on anti-corruption measures over 13 categories, saw the Free State receive especially low marks in the areas of political financing, executive accountability, internal auditing, and ethics enforcement. In 2017, Governor Hogan signed the Public Integrity Act, the first update to the state's ethics laws, in more than 10 years. So are ethics laws the key to restoring trust in government, or are they just a first step? I'm joined in the studio by the political strategist Catalina Byrd, Sean Yost of the Afro newspaper, and the organizer Davon Love of Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. You are welcome to join our conversation as well at 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. To follow me on Twitter, @TomHallWYPR. And we are also streaming on the WYPR Facebook page, so you can ping us there as well. We have an email from Maureen who says, your guests are too negative. Interesting. We had a couple of conversations about the article that appeared in the New York Times that Alec McGillis wrote, The Tragedy of Baltimore. So we talked to Alec about it, and we talked to some folks from Visit Baltimore and the Downtown Baltimore Partnership about, you know, the branding of Baltimore. People saying, you know, we got to be balanced. We got to talk about all the good things going on. There are some good things going on. Let's go to Susan in Baltimore on the phone. Susan, welcome to Midday. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
What's on your mind?
I appreciate the fact that Davon Love explained what some of the white power structures are that exert so much power, like the University of Maryland Medical System Board and the Greater Baltimore Committee. A couple of others that occurred to me were the Stronach Group that are involved with the racetrack stuff, and Johns Hopkins, another huge white corporate structure. My question is, what can be the next steps to, I don't know if the term is dismantling those power structures, but get people into them who really want the best for Baltimore?
So let me give some good news, because I think there is a point to be made about the nature of the kind of coverage that Baltimore gets. And as a person, I'll be 32 in May. I've had the privilege of, you know, studying under a lot of, you know, black folks in this city that have done amazing work that oftentimes doesn't get put to the public mainstream. So if I can just give a couple of examples, one is, and you actually mentioned Associated Black Charities as being in the midst of the scandal. And I think it's pretty clear, you know, that the mayor kind of used ABC as a pass-through for corporate entities. It's a pretty traditional kind of relationship. But I saw some people online kind of linking it to the Baltimore City Children and Youth Fund. And I think it's really important that people understand that the Baltimore City Children and Youth Fund was something that was created through kind of grassroots organizing to get the city council to put it through the, you know, make a charter amendment. You know, it was vetoed, overwritten by the council. There was a public process by which a task force was convened, which, you know, the Adam Jackson, who's CEO of LBS, was one of the co-chairs. Public meeting, you know, in City Hall. So it was open to the public. Conversations about, you know, what the governing structure of the youth fund should be. And there was an overwhelming emphasis on the importance of, you know, capacity building for grassroots organizations that traditionally don't get dollars. And so, again, Associated Black Charities was asked to serve as the entity to hold the fund as a result of work that myself, Adam, Danielle Terrain, who's now an independent consultant, Sam Mellison, who is now at the Burns Institute. Both Danielle and Sam were formerly at the Casey Foundation. LBS had been critiquing the nonprofit sector from the outside. Sam and Danielle had been trying to do some work on the inside. And so for years, we were trying to figure out how can we institutionalize an alternative. When the Youth Fund came along, we saw it as an opportunity to institutionalize an alternative to grant making that actually gets dollars to the grassroots. And so we actually went to Diane Bell McCoy and asked her.
She's the CEO of ABC.
We went to Diane and asked her if ABC would be willing to essentially anchor and hold the youth fund, basically the work that we would do on it, in order to protect it from interference from the kind of larger white philanthropic sector that we imagine will be threatened by an approach to grant making that would actually empower the grassroots and really undermine the white corporate sector ability to kind of curate the kinds of organizations that get dollars. And so, you know, to kind of fast forward to the good news is that we're in a process of actually being able to institutionalize a way of grant making where the general public, not your traditional kind of gatekeepers who are like nonprofit professionals who are typically able to be those gatekeepers. We're talking about people, regular everyday people that have the opportunity to participate and where those dollars go. Now, we're still in the process of building out the new intermediary that'll essentially hold the youth fund. And that'll essentially,
because it's not planned for the Associated Black Charities to run it forever.
Exactly. Yeah. The plan is for them to build a new intermediary.
But Catalina Byrd, I mean, do you have confidence, you personally, in ABC's credibility, given their involvement in, as Davon says, sort of serving as a pass-through for Mayor Pugh in these books? I mean, they themselves have changed their procedures. They returned $10,000, which I guess they had taken as kind of a fee for helping sell these books, and they've decided they're not going to do it in the future. So it seems to me that they're admitting that what they did was not according to best practices of nonprofit boards, at the very least.
My grandmother used to say hindsight is 20/20. I, as Davon has have worked and supported ABC for years, I believe that in the moment they might not have realized that there was something wrong with it, but as it came out, as an act of integrity and to show their character, they did what they had to do to move away from it so they could continue the work that they do. You know, unfortunately, I was upset to even see them be caught up in this, quite frankly, because they too for years have struggled with funding to be able to do the work that they do. And for them to be caught up in something like this at a very, very small, at the smallest dollar amount of any of the other entities that are involved was disheartening. But again, it's kind of the collateral damage that comes from corruption. And, you know, your email from Maureen that were being negative, you know, I think sometimes we don't like to look at the truth. You said, what were the things that could have unearthed this? Well, if everybody's looking away while the things are happening, and then nobody wants to talk about it when they get uncovered so we can figure out what processes and policies we need to change so that they don't happen again because they're not fun or lighthearted to talk about, that's how it continues to perpetuate. The reality is we have to pull the covers off of all of it. And this is really thankless work. I mean, it's not like Davon just popped up yesterday, right? For years, we've been saying these issues are what is happening in Baltimore politically. And if you have the benefit of not being a person of color or from our communities, you live completely oblivious to it. And then when someone brings it to your attention, you're offended. I mean, there's someone on Twitter blaming the black church, but the black church doesn't put the kind of money into campaigns that you get from the interest that we're talking about here. So, you know, and the saddest part of it is not even to be cynical. The other side of it is because this has gone on for so long, that's what feeds the apathy. And everybody keeps talking about turnout, turnout, turnout. But there's a direct correlation between the people who have stopped believing in the system and things of this nature and those turnout numbers when we talk about who needs what to win.
Stephanie emails, with the UMMS board, have they done this before? Let's face it, she writes, if they are comfortable doing this with Mayor Pugh, they probably did it for others. And in fact, Stephanie, there are eight others who've either resigned from the board or taken a leave of absence for contracts, many of which were issued in a no-bid process. If self-dealing is wrong for Mayor Pugh and charges are considered against her, Stephanie writes, then anybody who sat on the UMMS board and engaged in self-dealing also needs to be investigated. And Stephanie, I can assure you that that's happening. The state prosecutor is not just looking into Mayor Catherine Pugh. They're looking into the entire operation of the UMMS board. As a matter of fact, there's legislation that Speaker Bush and Senator Jill Carter proposed for this year that would, you know, greatly regulate. It would start with getting rid of everybody who's on the UMMS board at present and then starting from scratch. I mean, the cynicism angle of this, Sean Yost, Stephanie Rawlings-Blake won her election in 2011 with 10% of eligible voters in the city of Baltimore voting for her. Catherine Pugh won the primary over her closest opponent, Sheila Dixon, by 2,400 votes. She got 30-something percent, 36% of the Democratic primary votes. You know, there are 329,000 eligible voters in the city of Baltimore, and almost none of them were involved in electing Catherine Pugh. Is engagement also part of this?
Of course, but the magic number that I've heard bandied about for years is 30,000 people. You target 30,000 people to vote in any, especially a general election, and so I guess
in the primary, Catherine Pugh got 48,709 votes,
which was right. So engagement is always going to be the perpetual challenge, I suspect. But the real challenge, and let me say this, let me preface this with, I'm a son of West Baltimore. I love my city. I think that the people of this city, the beautifully resilient people of this city, are the greatest resource of this city. So I'm always optimistic about my city. But at the same time, that it's harder. It becomes harder each day to continue with that level of optimism, because we're being inundated by from every angle. What else is left for us to kind of grapple with as we go forward as community leaders? I mean, to answer your question, though, yes, engagement is incredibly important. But if you think that there's cynicism or negativity or whatever adjective you want to attach to our commentary, if you think that's prevalent in this conversation, think about what it's like. The people on the street, the people on the ground gave up have given up a long time ago.
And Dave, I know we've got a minute left. How do you get people to not give up? How do we get rid of the corruption and the culture of corruption? And then how do we get voters and citizens to stay engaged?
Well, I would say two things. One is that it's going to be really important for people to see things happen in their communities. And so I think there are many people that are doing things in their communities on a daily basis. And so when people see things happen, I mean, that's a big part of, I think, how LBS has been able to get the credibility we've gotten, is because people have seen these aren't, you know, huge things, but people have been able to see enough where people believe in the organization and we're interested in being a part of the work to elevate other folks. The other thing, it's going to be very important for us to address the media, you know, and I think it's important for the media to cover all the things that typically don't get covered so that more of the people in Baltimore can really see what's happening and get on board.
Davon Love is the Director of Public Policy for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, and Catalina Bird is a media consultant and political strategist, and Sean Yost, he's the Baltimore editor of The Afro and co-host of the WIPR podcast Truth and Reconciliation. His latest book is called After Freddie Gray, Real Stories from One of America's Great imperiled cities. Thanks to all of you. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom.
That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, a recap of the 2019 Maryland General Assembly, which concludes tonight at midnight. WYPR's Rachel Bay, Josh Kurtz of Maryland Matters, and the Daily Record's Brian Sears will join me for a look at what bills passed and what bills did not. Thanks to the Diz for supplying lunch today. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served on the weekends. You can find them on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
This is 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station.